You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It is The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Anna Sale in today for Leonard. Mary Roach's latest book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, investigates how digestion works from start to finish. She introduces us to the scientists who study the complex bodily processes that fuel our bodies and keep us alive. And Gulp is The Leonard Lopate Show Book Club April selection. The paperback edition is published by Norton and by Norton. We hope that you've been reading the book along with us. I'm so glad to welcome its author, Mary Roach, back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hello, Mary.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
So first thing I've learned about Mary Roach is do not chew in front of her. This poor person in the newsroom has had his number of chews counted while we waited for the show to go on. So you've been warned. But Mary Roach, I want to ask you first, the way you describe human physiology and the way we're built around our digestion. At one point, you compare us to earthworms with just some more sophisticated tools to get the food inside of us.
We are basically a big tube with a little with some things sticking out here and there. Yeah, well, that it sort of all began with the big tube. And then, well, you got to maybe grow some arms and legs to kind of like move around. You got to have some mobility to get to some food. And then you need the brain to run the arms and legs. But really, it's all in service of the tube.
Service of the tube. And this book covers the tube from start to finish. We invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you've been reading along, call us at 212-433-9692 with your comments or questions for Mary Roach. You can also leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org or write to us on Facebook and Twitter. Mary, you got to know your tube pretty well at one point. You chose to do a colonoscopy without sedation.
That is correct.
What did you see?
Well, the most amazing thing about the colon is that it is, you know, it is this organ that we associate with feces, for want of a better word. So you kind of have a sense of it as this filthy, dirty, brown place. And of course, it's been cleaned out before a colonoscopy, but it's this glistening, bubblegum pink, clean, sort of beautiful environment. And there's one journal paper where they published side by side a photograph of sort of the segments and the entryways between segments of the intestines, and then next to it the architecture of Gaudi, and they were commenting on how, you know, there was beauty in both. So it's actually a beautiful place, and it's kind of inspiring. It's a little difficult to focus on that while having someone navigate a tube around the corners of the colon, which is quite an uncomfortable thing. But it's not actually as bad as you. The pain isn't as bad as you would think.
So tell me about your process in choosing to write about digestion. We love to talk about food. We love to talk about how we're hungry. We do not love to talk about what happens once we eat that food. Why did you decide to go down this pathway?
I think because we do love to talk about and write about and read about food. We are a culture that reveres food and revels in food and cuisine and cooking. And we look at photographs of beautiful food. But as soon as you start to chew it, the focus disappears. Nobody wants to think about what happens from that point onward. When in fact, to me, it's as interesting as a beautiful gorgonzola and walnut galette or whatever. There's these amazing processes and mechanisms that are going on all the time on our behalf. Just incredible, the human stomach. Why doesn't it burst if you overeat? There's these safety mechanisms, the teeth and chewing. That like when you bite down on a peanut, all of a sudden, when it breaks, your jaw muscles automatically adjust so that you don't smash your teeth together. All of these little tiny things going on completely that were unknown to us. And so I think it's as interesting or more interesting than the food itself. And I just thought it would be fun to welcome people along on the ride and to take a look at, you know, it's not the food itself, but how we kind of process it and what goes on.
You mentioned
in the big tube.
In the big tube, you mentioned jaw muscles and what happens during chewing. But let's start with spit and saliva.
Yeah.
What happens when you put a piece of food inside your mouth?
When you start to chew, you produce stimulated saliva. That is, chewing stimulates saliva. And you could chew on anything in your body will be like, all right. I mean, it doesn't have to be food. You'll produce saliva. And that's actually how you, researchers who study saliva, there's something called the saliva collection system. It's basically like a tampon that you chew and your body's going, okay, doesn't seem like my idea of a good lunch, but all right, if you want to get that down, I'll help you.
So no judgment.
Yeah, go ahead. We'll produce some saliva for you. So it, and then you have this, wad of cotton that absorbs it, and then it can be put in a centrifuge, and then you end up with this little beaker full of saliva. And that kind of saliva is 99% water, same consistency, looks like water, actually a beautiful looking in a clean little beaker. You'd think, wow, I could drink that down, but no one will, not even a saliva researcher. I was in the Netherlands with this woman, Erica Saletti, who studies saliva, and we did this process, and I said, Erica, that's basically just water, and it's your own. You produced it. Would you drink that? She said, no. She said, I know. It's from my own mouth. No. And I kept kind of pushing her, and finally she's like, no.
Drawing the line.
But it's fascinating because it's as long as it's in the mouth, we're all right with it. But once it leaves the body, then it disgusts us. It's a very, you can sort of chart the boundaries of the self. You know, if it's you start chewing food, you stick out your tongue, you'll bring it back in, that's okay. So that's sort of part of the self. But once it leaves the mouth, even your own food, there's psychologists who've done studies on disgust, where if you imagine spitting into a bowl of your favorite soup, now, how likely would you be to consume that soup? Well, almost nobody will agree to eat this food that is their favorite food, and it's their own saliva. And almost nobody will do it. It's a strange substance.
I'm talking to Mary Roach about her book, Gulp, New in Paperback. It's the Leonard Lopate Show April selection for the book club. If you've read along, give us a call, 212-433-9692. Speaking of revulsion, another thing that you look at a lot is what we're willing to eat and what we're not, and the cultural influences mm-hmm. around that. One of the most interesting discussions is around organs.
Yeah.
Because you point out that in the wild, for many predators, that's the place you go first because it's so nutrient rich. What's going on with humans and organs?
Right. In much of the world, organs and the kind of extraneous bits, the non-muscle meats, are considered the most flavorful parts of the beast, and they aren't spurned. Our culture is particularly squeamish. We tend to just want to eat the muscle meat, which is the least nutritious. Up in the Arctic, where you can't be growing fruits and vegetables, organ meats are. That's where you get your vitamins and minerals. So I was up in the Arctic for a community feast, and it was amazing. They kind of lay down some cardboard on the ground, and they bring over all pieces of caribou and walrus, and everything was eaten. Everything was consumed, including the bone marrow, and at the end they pulled up the cardboard and used it to wipe their hands. I love the food groups exist up there, and in the food group fruits and vegetables, it says 100 grams of organ meats. But anyway, in our culture, it's a status thing. We came to associate the eating of organ meats with the lower classes. Oh, they can't afford the good cuts. And only recently, when now there started to be restaurants where it's become trendy to eat sweetbreads, bone marrow even. So it's starting to become acceptable in this culture. But without that sort of shift in status, it's very hard to get a group of people to change their notion of what is good to eat. In World War II, there was a concerted effort on the part of the government to get Americans to embrace organ meats because a lot of the regular cuts were going overseas. So they brought in Margaret Mead, an anthropologist. How can we get people to eat organ meats? They came up with a nice euphemism, variety meats. Mm-hmm. They would try to, they'd like go to
Sounds
PTA.
Fun.
Yeah, variety meats. You can sort of picture somebody in a spangly outfit.
So those are meats that are associated with status but are actually good for us that we don't eat in this culture. Bob from Ringo Park writes in to ask, what foods cause serious digestive problems? Are there also foods that, depending on where people derived, it's more difficult to eat and it causes digestive problems, like dairy?
Oh, right. Lactose intolerance. There's a The rates of that in Asian Americans, African Americans, is something like 75% in adults and 25% in Caucasians. So there are some really basic differences, depending on where you're from. It's interesting because that's only in adults. The consumption of milk as an adult. I was talking to some researcher who said, once you're weaned, there's really no reason for you to be consuming milk. It's not a normal thing. And in a lot of the world, you wouldn't sit down and have a glass of milk with a meal. But we in this country, and also in the Netherlands, people still drink milk with meals as adults. So, that's an example.
Let's move to the stomach from the mouth. We've chewed up food. It goes into our stomach. Why doesn't the stomach digest itself?
A couple of reasons. The stomach has a mucus layer, which is a protective layer barrier. Also, the stomach lining regenerates very quickly. You have a new stomach lining every 3 days, I'm told. So the stomach has all sorts of protective mechanisms. Another question I was curious about is why is it? It's very hard to rupture a human stomach. You can overeat to a tremendous, as you know from competitive eating contests. The thing is
personal experience.
Yeah, it's very hard to do it, and the reason is that there are a couple of safety mechanisms. One of them, this is my favorite, the transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxation, which is a burp. Okay, so if you've overeaten and then you have Alka-Seltzer and you create a lot of sort of a quick burst of gas to the stomach, that can be dangerous. So what does your body do? It gets rid of the gas. And if you persist, if you keep eating more, your stomach, there are stretch receptors, and it can tell when it's reaching the danger zone, and you will reflexively regurgitate. So throwing up is a safety mechanism. And I asked a competitive eater, I said, well, okay, you have the same stomach as anyone else and the same reflexes. How are you getting around this reflexive regurgitation? And he said, well, this is going to sound really gross, but we don't really. We just, the rule is the food can come up, but it can't come out. So we swallow it back down. So that's one way to get around the safety mechanism. So anyway, the stomach is, it's an astounding place.
And what causes heartburn? What does that tell
that
us?
Is heartburn is when the sphincter's it's like a door that's not shutting properly. It's leaking, so some of the acid from the stomach is getting up into the esophagus, and you have it causes irritation. Yeah.
Okay. So then we go from the stomach to the small intestines, and let's differentiate the small intestines from the large intestines.
Yeah.
How they're different. And also how we found out about how they work.
Right. Well, the small intestine is where most of the absorption of nutrients for the stomach turns the food into sort of a slurry called chyme. Okay. So that's and it does this with enzymes and acids and also a muscular kind of churning and breaking down. And so when it's ready to go, the stomach sort of spurts it into the small intestine. The small intestine, you can swallow a pill cam, so you can see the whole tube. And each section, stomach, small intestine, large intestine, look completely different. It's one long tube, but there's definitely different chambers. And the small intestine, it's almost like terry cloth in that, like a towel, it needs to be absorbing. It needs a lot of surface area. So the little loops on terry cloth are basically increasing the surface area for absorbing. So the small intestine has these, it's a very Dr. Seuss looking place, little fingers sticking up. And it's pink, not as bright pink as the colon, but it's, so there's these little wiggling villi, they're called, that are increasing the surface area for absorption. So that's where all you're taking in of nutrients, not all of it, but most of it is happening in the small intestine. And then we go through the ileocecal valve, which is a one-way valve, into the large intestine, the colon, the lovely bubblegum pink with the glistening smooth sides, no little wiggling fingers. And that's where the material is, it's being dried out, and it's also, the rectum is is the very end of the colon. That's a holding tank, if you will. And it's nice to have that so that you can finish a conversation or finish whatever you're doing. You don't have to immediately be a slave to the demands of your intestinal tract. So then you have the holding and drying area, and eventually again, with stretch receptors, yeah, that gets full. And it's like a compost bin. It's full. The stuff that you're excreting is it's things that you couldn't absorb. So it's and the more vegetable, woody, fibrous stuff you eat, the more quickly you're going to have to empty the compost bin. So that's why fibrous food makes you more regular, as they like to say.
That brings us to the end of the digestive process, but not the end of this interview. I'm speaking with Mary Roach. We've been reading her book, Gulp: Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, for this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. If you have a question for Mary Roach, give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We'll be back with Mary Roach after a break. I'm Anna Sale in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking to Mary Roach about her latest book, Gulp: Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. It's the Leonard Lopate Show April selection for our book club. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692 if you have any questions for Mary Roach. We got a question from your friend Steve from Scientific American, Mary. He wrote in to ask you to talk about the fistulated cow. Tell us about that cow.
Steve Mirsky. Hey, Steve. The fistulated cow. Oh, yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. I always forget about the fistulated cow. A fistulated cow, this is a cow with an opening into its rumen, which is a large, basically, fermenter. Cows, the digestive tract works a little differently. It's bacteria breaking down things that our system couldn't break down, like grasses. So this is this big old tank that you, and the fistulated cow has an opening that's, you can sort of seal it off and open it up, and you can reach inside.
It has a hole in its
side. It has a hole. Yes, thank you. It has a hole in its side. And you can put your arm, your hand, your arm, all the way up to the shoulder. You are wearing a long sleeve of the type that artificial inseminators wear. Huh. It's like a all the way to the shoulder plastic sleeve, and you can and it's funny to watch people. There are photographs of me putting my arm into this cow, and it's like, they have sort of a quizzical look at first, and I'm only up to the, you know, to the wrist at this point, and they kept saying, you know, go further, no, you can go further, and then you get further in, and you start to feel this powerful, it's like an industrial grinder. There's these muscular contractions moving this material around, and it's hot in there. It's like a compost heap. It's very warm, and it's at one point I thought, you know, am I in danger of breaking my little finger here? These powerful, and the cow, of course, the cow is just completely oblivious. Oh yeah, it's another person with their arm in my rumen, and I have come to the farm, you know. I'm wearing like kitten heels and a skirt for some reason. I thought, well, I'm doing an interview. I need to. So I'm stepping around these cow pies and puddles of urine. And then I have my arm up to the shoulder in the cow. But just an amazing to feel that process.
Was it hot?
It's very warm in there. It's very hot. In the same way when your compost pile is really cooking, it's hot. And that is, it's bacteria are breaking down all these fairly challenging things to break down. And what's interesting, you know, nowadays there are, the fecal transplant is a treatment for certain infections in the colon. Farmers have been doing this for years. Fistulated cow would be one way to do it, but they can also sort of put it in the rear door. But there, anyway, that's been known for a long time. You can take some material from one cow's intestine and put it in another, and the healthy cow's microbiome will start taking over in the sick cow, and it's fairly effective. So a fistula enables research, nutrition research. There's reasons other than just entertaining Mary Roach. There are other reasons to have a fistula in a cow at an ag school.
We've also found out a lot about digestion from people who had holes in their bellies. Tell us the story about St. Martin and how that experiment went underway.
Sure, yeah. William Beaumont was an army physician in the early 1800s who came to treat a trapper who had a hole blown in his stomach. It was an accident with a gun. And the hole in the stomach, it didn't heal. And so Beaumont, Dr. Beaumont, realized that he could, with a light source, put his eye right up to this hole and see these juices being secreted and these contractions. And he thought, well, this is a terrific opportunity to study the process of digestion and to figure out, how is it mechanical? Is it chemical? How quickly does it work? Do these juices work outside the body? So Alexis St. Martin, who was the stomach under consideration, was kind of recruited, and this relationship went on for 30 years. Eventually, St. Martin was paid, and he would every now and then get fed up and take off, and then Beaumont would send word through various messengers that, I'd like you to come back. I will pay for your family. I will give you I'll give you a higher stipend. And St. Martin would kind of hold out because it really was a seller's market. There's not a lot of stomachs like that are available. So they kind of, there was this sort of coyote and roadrunner back and forth of like, I know I can, this time I won't let him go. So Beaumont, Beaumont was the first to, well, he wasn't actually the first. There was some work done in Italy with researchers who would eat food and then regurgitate it. So that was another way. What Beaumont would do is just put it in a mesh bag into the stomach, it was on a string, pull it back out at intervals, see what was left, what was digested.
We're getting some calls from readers. Jim in the Bronx, what's your question for Mary Roach?
Hi, how are you? I want to raise the issue of why people are disgusted by bodily fluids, including their own. Do not scientists maintain that this disgust is based on a sort of evolutionary adaptation, that bodily fluids contain all kinds of pathogens, disease-bearing organisms? That's why it's illegal to spit, for instance, in public. It's why people are disgusted by this, the smell of feces. But there's a very good, very rational, and very useful basis of disgust for bodily secretions, and I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks for your call, Jim. Mary, is our disgust response keeping us safe?
Particularly with fecal material. But what's interesting about saliva is there are a lot of bacteria, but there's also quite impressive antibacterial materials. There was a study I came across where they looked at, it was a rodent study, and they disconnected the salivary system in one group of animals. So they weren't, when they had a wound, they weren't able to lick it because animals tend to lick a wound. And without the saliva, the wound healed more slowly. Mm-hmm. So saliva it's got not only antimicrobial, but antiviral and nerve growth factors and skin growth factors. And so it's an interesting substance in that, yes, there are a lot of germs, but it's also, it has certain healing properties and is, less of a danger than, and there's a myth that human bites, like fight bites, like if you punch someone and you have a wound on your hand, that won't heal. They did a study, and in, I think it was 62 human bites, only one or two became infected. So saliva isn't quite as straightforward in that sense of it being a danger, but certainly on the other end, for sure.
I want to ask you about that disgust response and what it's meant for the science around digestion and what we know about it. I mean, the thing that's amazing and wonderful about your book is there is no question that you will shy away from. And some of the best lines are where you mentioned the emails you wrote to people that didn't get responses. But how do you feel like, how has our revulsion or discomfort with the process of digestion, how has that gotten in the way of our understanding of what's happening inside of us?
Well, I looked at the fecal transplant or bacteria therapy, as it's more tidily known, I guess. And this is something that for treating C. difficile, which kills 20,000 or more people a year. It's a it's a chronic colon infection, and a fecal transplant is a very quick, effective, and cheap cure. And I was like, well, this has been known for quite some time, and why has it taken so long to catch on? And is it the ick factor? But in fact, I mean, I think that does, we do have this intuitive sense that that's not something we want to put someone else's microbiome into our bodies. But it also has to do with the fact that there's not a pharmaceutical company or a device maker who's shepherding the process or the product through and funding it and funding the testing. You know, how does an insurance company bill for feces? You know, what's the code? How much do we charge? How do you even put it into the system? So that was also a part of why it had taken so long to gain acceptance. But it's an interesting, you know, there was an advocacy group for anal cancer, and on their website they talked about how for so many years there was no colored ribbon, there was no 20K run to raise money for anal cancer, and like that it was sort of the orphaned cancer because no one wanted to talk about it. You know, there's a stigma attached to it, also because there's a sexual transmission element to it. But it's interesting to look at. You know, are there diseases that maybe we would have made more progress a little bit sooner if it weren't so off-putting.
Has looking so closely at digestion changed your personal habits? Amy asked this question on our show page. Are you eating differently now that you've looked so closely at this?
Yes, I make use of my internal nostrils, which I never used. I didn't know I had internal nostrils. We have two sets of nostrils, the ones in the nose that we use to sniff and smell food on the inhale, and there's also an opening at the back of the mouth into the nose when you're exhaling. You're wafting those aromatic elements that are in your mouth. Say you have wine in your mouth, you're wafting them up into the nose. So you gain more appreciation for your food by doing this, and so I do that. I think I get a sort of odd look on my face when I'm trying to blow the food. And you don't want to do this too hard because then you wander into the realm of nasal regurgitation where you hork it out your nose.
It sounds uncomfortable. If I were to try using my internal nostrils, what's the best food, or should I stick with wine?
Anything with beer with kind of a lot of complex, volatile, you know, aromatic, something that any time you take a food in and you chew it up and you're chewing it and you're warming it, so you're releasing these gases. So what you're doing in your mouth and the fact that your mouth is warm is all contributing to the flavors that you're experiencing by releasing those gases, and so they go up into your nose. So chewing slowly, not ridiculously slowly, but holding food in your mouth and chewing it and paying attention to what's going on in your mouth. So I've slowed down, I think, and I just pay a little more attention
to what you're eating. More appreciation,
yes,
for the process.
Yes.
Mary Roach, her latest book is Gulp: Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. It is the Leonard Lopate Show April Book Club pick. Leave your comments, questions on our show page. Mary Roach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. ¶¶